Go. So today is November 3rd, 2020. This is Abel Gomez and Ariel Mejia for the Center for the Study of Religion in the City, COVID-19 Relief and Restoration Work, interview one with Baltimore Ceasefire. So I'm wondering if you could start by just telling us a little bit about your organization.
Okay. So, I'm sorry, because I will be talking with apples in my mouth. I apologize. So Baltimore Ceasefire 365 is a citywide movement. We are not an organization yet. So it is all volunteer driven. Nobody gets paid. We do have a fiscal sponsor and so we're able to take donations like a nonprofit does, and it is tax deductible when people donate to us. It started as one weekend in August, a three-day weekend asking for everybody in the city to be peaceful and to celebrate life. Although it's called Ceasefire, it is also called the Baltimore Peace Challenge for people who think, oh, well, I wasn't planning on shooting anybody anyway, right? The goal really is for all of us to be peaceful intentionally and on purpose for an extended amount of time, that we're all intentionally raising our vibration and that we're celebrating life on purpose. And so we ask people to host life-affirming events, which means they can do anything they want in their community that celebrates life. They let us know about it. We put it on the calendar. And so what started, so it was August of 2017. August 4th through 6th was the first ceasefire weekend. And then we decided to do it every 3 months. So then it became February, May, August, and November. It's always the very first Friday through Sunday of the month, except in May, we always do it Mother's Day weekend. And so the May ceasefire is dedicated to parents who've lost their children to violence, not just moms, because in general, when mothers lose their children to violence, they're very vocal. You know, in general, women are socialized to be vocal about their pain in ways that men are not. So for men, anger is really the only emotion men are, you know, that's socially acceptable for men to show. And so a thing like homicide, snatching your child, mothers are extremely vocal. They're all over the news. They start foundations in their children's name. They get streets named after their kids. Fathers, we don't know what fathers are often going through because they're just not as vocal publicly anyway, right? And so it dawned on me one day. So my brother, one of my brothers was killed in January of 2007. And my parents, neither of my parents remember the actual date that my brother was killed. I think me and my other brothers do, but my parents have, it's just gone out of their memory. But my father, on my brother's birthday, my father calls everybody in the family to see how we're doing. On my birthday, my father calls me to see how I'm doing because my birthday often triggers mourning for me about my brother. Because my birthday was one of the last times me and my brother spent together. Him and my dad took me out to brunch. That was October, and then that January, my brother got killed. So my father knows that my birthday can be hard for me. So one time, my father was doing his, you know, rounds, calling everybody to see how we were doing. And I said, Daddy, how you doing? And this man just, like, broke down like my brother had just died all over again. And so, and my father is one of the most emotionally intelligent men that I know. He is very, you know, comfortable with vulnerability and sharing his emotions and all of that kind of stuff. So for a man like my dad to have it in his mind that it like is his job to check on everybody else's emotional state, but the minute you ask him how he's doing, he just like falls apart and nobody even knew that's how he was feeling for real. If he's going through that, I can't imagine what most men are going through who are not as comfortable with showing their emotions and all of that kind of stuff. Like, how much stuffing must they be doing? So that, and that interaction with my father made me say, oh, we need to make sure that we are honoring fathers who lose their children to violence. And so for that May ceasefire, we ask that people especially use the Saturday, because everybody's going to focus on mothers on Sunday anyway, because it's Mother's Day. So we ask for Saturdays for people to really be thoughtful and intentional about doing things that support fathers' joy, that pour into dads, you know, that give them an opportunity to feel celebrated and cared for and remembered in their pain of losing their children. So it started as just these weekends that we do four times a year. And then it became, and during those weekends, if somebody gets killed, we show up at the location where the murder happened. We invite everybody in the city to come, and we make it a sacred space. We pour light and love into the space. We burn sage and frankincense and camphor and all kinds of medicines to help clear energy, and put love and light into the space. And we also contact the family, and we're able to give them money just as a love offering. There's no stipulation on how they have to use the money. We understand that this kind of trauma, when there's stipulations to how somebody is loving you, right? That's not the same thing as just giving me love right now because I'm impacted by this horrible trauma, right? So we just give the money as a love offering, no questions, no forms they got to fill out, nothing. And so those are the things we do when somebody is killed during the ceasefire. But in November of 2017, we began doing that at every murder location in the city. So it's called Sacred Space Rituals. When they happen at 7 o'clock, which they first, all of them started, all of them happened at 7 o'clock when we first started doing it. And so we called it Sacred Seven. So inclusiveness is a huge value of the movement. And so 7 o'clock is generally a time anybody can get anywhere. But seven as a number is very strong. It's the number of collective consciousness. It's the energy of collective consciousness. And so it's called Sacred Seven when we do them at 7 o'clock. But in general, they're called Sacred Space Rituals. And so beginning in November of 2017, we began going to every murder location. So every time somebody got killed, we scheduled a time to show up and bless the space and make it sacred ground and honor the person's life. It also is about sending love and light into the neighborhood that's impacted by the murder, but also sending love and light to the journey of the person who committed the murder. Because we understand violence as a public health issue and as an epidemic. And if we just take people who kill people and we just pile them in a corner somewhere and cancel them, we're never gonna end an epidemic like murder, right? And so if people are not loved and if they don't have new opportunities and access to new choices after they've taken a life, all they ever learn is about their worthlessness, not their worthiness. And so that's also a big part of what we're doing in that space, is we're sending love and light to the journey of the person who did this thing. And it's, so that is just a new way that Baltimore responds to murder. Instead of being numb and saying, oh, condolences to the family, yeah, somebody else got killed, right? We ask people, just pause, just notice somebody got killed in your city, you know, show up at the space with us to do whatever you want in that space, in that neighborhood, to put love and light there. And even if you can't, notice when we're going to be in neighborhoods and pause in your day to send some love or say a little prayer or something. So it's a new way of reacting and responding to murder. We also do have what we call ceasefire schools, which now are not just schools. So any kind of organization, a neighborhood, a block, a fraternity, a sorority, a church, a synagogue, a mosque, any kind of organization, hospital, so the University of Maryland School of Social Work is now a ceasefire organization. So basically what this means, it started with schools. So what it means is that you are an organization who has agreed to make the ceasefire culture a part of the fabric of your organization. So a few things. We as a movement give them a training. So students, staff, parents, people who live in the community who don't even have any students at the school. So people in that community, we give an 8-hour training. That's in person. Online, it is a 6-hour training now during these COVID days. But as we break it up over day, you know, over time if people need to. But it's a 6-hour training online. And it teaches emotional intelligence, conflict management. It teaches the values of the movement, the stance of the movement, how to do outreach, how to have compassion for people, even when they are resistant to a message of nonviolence, how to help connect people with resources that they need when you're having conversations with them about what's really going on in their life. So people get that training. We also commit to giving them what we call like a starter kit of outreach materials, so ceasefire posters and flyers. Because of COVID right now, we haven't been printing things, so people can go to our website on the Get Involved page. It's always the most recent. We change the logo every ceasefire season, so 4 times a year the logo changes. Because it's Baltimore, and you got to be dope. And if your logo is not dope, and if your message is not dope, you know what I mean? People like, I mean, yeah, it's whatever. But do you want the T-shirt, though? Right? So that's really... So we change the logo every quarter, and the colors are very intentional. So the February ceasefire is always Black people colors, red, black, green, and gold. I'm losing my brain. May is spring colors. August is always autumn colors like oranges and stuff like that. And then the August ceasefire is always the original red, black, and white colors. So because August was the very first ceasefire we had, the red, black, and white is the main ceasefire logo. And so that's always the color of the August ceasefire stuff. So we give, so since we're not printing materials now during COVID precautions, instead, when people complete the training that we do at their school or organization, they get a t-shirt. So we have a line of Peace Goon t-shirts. So the idea behind being a Peace Goon is understanding that murder and violence are very arrogant energies. They are very persistent. Murder shows up like, fuck y'all, we're gonna have this whole block on lock. We're gonna have y'all paralyzed. You know what I mean? And so if you are going to engage with an energy like murder as consistently and as closely as we do, you have to be just as persistent, just as arrogant and unrelenting around your goal. And so, and we're not letting murder have dominion over our city. And so we are peace goals. And so there are 6 of us who are organizers of the movement. So our t-shirts, it has the Baltimore ceasefire logo on the front. And then on the back, it says Peace Goon. You can become a ceasefire ambassador. So these are people who not only go through that training, but their training is similar to the community one that we do in schools and for organizations, except it is more focused on what it means to be a leader in the ceasefire movement. So ambassadors are leaders. Right now we have 51 ambassadors and 20 of them are youth. So ambassadors, their t-shirt has the ceasefire logo on the front and there says certified Peace Goon on the back. And so everybody who goes through a training because their school or organization has become a ceasefire organization, theirs has the ceasefire logo on the front and theirs says community Peace Goon on the back. And so they're getting those t-shirts, especially during COVID, because we aren't able to give them flyers and posters to put all over their community. So we have the weekends, we have ambassadors, we have ceasefire schools and other kinds of organizations and sacred space rituals. So right now, those are all of the things that the movement does 365 days a year. And it all started with one three-day weekend in August of 2017. So I know that was a long answer to your question, but.
That was a very rich answer. And there's a bunch that I want to kind of go back to. You mentioned that this is a movement and not necessarily a formal organization, but that there are various individual entities that become part of this movement and get trainings and then participate in these different events. So to take a step back, I'm curious if you could just say a little bit more about the name and where it came from and mm-hmm. and what it is that you are communicating with that name.
That's good. So so the idea of calling a ceasefire in Baltimore is not new. People have done it before. It has never been done in this way where it belongs to everybody in the city. So it's always in the past been, oh, this particular organization or person is calling a ceasefire. And so it means really only the people associated with that organization ever find out about it, right? And if you happen to not bind with that organization, right, you might read the flyer and be like, these people phony, I'm not participating in it. You know what I mean? So this guy named Ogun had an idea to have one day where everybody in the city agreed we're not going to shoot each other today, right? And he took this idea to several men in Baltimore who are leaders. All of these men told him it was stupid, it wasn't going to work, they were not wasting their energy on it. He figured, oh, if you want something done, you must need to take it to a Black woman. And so he brought it to me. After all the men told him no, he came to me and I was like, of course that's something we should do. I don't know why we haven't done that before, right? Okay. So that was 2015. Him and I didn't, we knew of each other because we had common friends, but we didn't really know each other. So we played phone tag for a minute and then we went back to our regular lives really, and we never really talked about it until 2017 came around. And my son, who was 19 at the time, had been watching the news with him. He was an AmeriCorps member at the Mediation Center at the time. And him and his other co-workers had been watching the news that day. And it was all over the news how Baltimore had the highest murder rate than it had ever had per capita. And so when we were riding home from work together, he told me this and I got mad and I was like, well, that's some bullshit. How is that possible? All this good work all of the people are doing in the city, how is the murder rate higher than it's ever been? And you know, when we get mad about things, the way our brains work, we often get defensive, right? And so we start pointing fingers about what other people should be doing and how come other people aren't doing things. And specifically in Baltimore, there are organizations that have strong connections to gangs, and they brag about those connections all the time. So I was fussing like, why won't they call a ceasefire? If they got connections to the street, if they say do it, everybody will honor it, right? So I'm fussing all the way home. I wake up the next morning, I'm still mad as a bitch about the whole situation. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm gonna be cussing. Did I tell y'all I was gonna be cussing? Okay.
That's great.
And so being that angry about what other people weren't doing made me realize I was the they I was mad at, right? Because here Ogun had given me this idea 2 years prior and we hadn't moved on it yet. It's now 2017, right? So I stopped fussing about who should be doing whatever. I called the very people I was fussing about and I said, hey, if we called the ceasefire in the city, would you participate? Would you get all your people on board? And before I could even finish the sentence, people were like, oh yes, and it shouldn't just be about shooting. This one guy told me like, yeah, my sister got killed because of domestic violence. And so it's all violence. We got to be saying no to all violence during whatever the ceasefire is. So I knew that we would have people on board, right? So I called Ogun that day. It was, I think, like early May. I called Ogun and I said, yo, you had this idea, you wanted to do a day. I want to really talk to you about it now. Because in my spirit, it wasn't just going to be one day. It was supposed to be 3 days. And it needed to be Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, not just Saturday and Sunday, because shit be popping off on Friday night. So we needed to just grab up the whole weekend, and that people should just be celebrating life all over the city. So it's not just a call to peace, but it's a call to life celebration, because a place like Baltimore, the narrative is very easily about how much our lives are not worth, or this belief that we must not care about our lives, and it's just simply not true. And so Baltimore needed to remind itself, we actually like life. We like celebrating our lives. So let's do that for 3 days straight, all at the same time. So the idea was about using, because violence is nurtured by collective consciousness. It's all of us participating in the imagery, in the narratives, the music we listen to, the movies we choose to watch, the memes we share on social media, all of it, right? We nurture this culture of violence. And so if we use that same energy, and it's creative energy, look what we've created, believing so much in the power of violence, right? We created a violent world. So what would happen if we took that same creative energy all at the same time and focused it just on peace and just on celebrating life, only for 3 days? It's just something, let's just try, right? So I wasn't calling it anything at first. After me and Ogun talked, we agreed, yep, 3 days celebrating life. It won't belong to any organization. My name won't be attached to it. Your name won't be attached to it. It'll just belong to Baltimore. I said, okay, great. Right now it's being called a life over death weekend. So I started making Facebook and Instagram posts, letting people know when to come to this community meeting where we would introduce this idea and get everybody's input. So from the very beginning, the movement was about inclusiveness and collaboration. So bringing people together to say, what do you think about this idea? Will you participate in it? What else do you think we need to do to make it actually move? About 15 to 20 people showed up at that meeting on May 9th, 2017. And they named it Baltimore Ceasefire and Baltimore Peace Challenge. Because when you say ceasefire, you don't have to explain what that means. You know that it means don't nobody kill nobody. Right? You know that that's what that means, right? So the peace challenge part is for people who don't view themselves as violent, right? Because the average person will tell you, I'm not a violent person unless I'm defending myself, or, you know, but the average person will say, I'm not violent, so y'all must not be talking to me. Yes, we're talking to everybody, because although you don't think you're violent, if I ask you, are you as peaceful as you can possibly be? You would say no, right? So for 3 days, can you make a commitment to be as peaceful as you can possibly be? Every thought, every word, every deed, you are being intentional about being peaceful. And so it includes everybody, and that's how the name came to be. And then after we did the first weekend in August, we named it Baltimore Ceasefire 365, because we realized we aren't just going to be doing, it's not about this one weekend. We at least knew we were going to do it every 3 months. We had no idea we were going to also train ambassadors and go to every murder space and have ceasefire organized. Like, I'm telling you, had God told me all of this shit, I probably would have been like, never mind. I'm not saying none of this out loud. Like, yeah.
Well, I definitely have some more questions to ask you, but I'm going to hand it over to Ariel to see if you have a question that you want to ask.
No, I don't really have a question. I just have comments. Like, that was just amazing, just hearing all that. I like how you talked about kind of like also in a way forgiving the people that committed the crime, because I feel like that's also pretty important too, because I feel like a lot of people like they acknowledge the person that committed the crime, but it's always in like a negative way and not in like a rehabilitating way.
Yeah.
So I thought that was super important. But yeah, I just, this sounds so amazing. Like everything.
What I want to say about that is we have to understand that redemption is a real thing. Right. And so when you call somebody a murderer, it does a few things. One, you are saying that's all they ever have been, right? That's all they are now. And in real life, nobody is only one thing, you know? As no matter how much we don't like shit they do, you will talk to people who love them and you will be like, oh my God, they are actually a decent human being somewhere inside of them, right? But specifically in relation to violence and murder, that's even more true because it's hypocritical of us as a society to just call people murderers as if they just were an island unto themselves and they decide to kill somebody one day. There were a lot of things that led to the moment they pulled the trigger, the moment they stabbed somebody, the moment, right? And it is very difficult to find what do they call people who commit crimes? An offender. It's very difficult to find an offender who was not first a victim, right? So you can go into any prison and just start asking people about their life story. And you will find out they were a victim of so many failed systems, so much oppression, abuse, violence, sexual assault. Like they've been victims of all kinds of trauma. And so because we live in a society that teaches us that violence is power and then doesn't teach us how to resolve our conflicts peacefully. Think about like, where have you actually been nurtured in real conflict management skills, how to respond even when you've been wronged, how do you speak your truth without attacking the other person, right? These are not things we value as a society, and the way you can tell is because it's not taught in schools. It's not, you don't learn it at work unless you happen to get into the field of alternative dispute resolution or some kind of field like that, you know? But other than that, conflict management and emotional intelligence and understanding how trauma impacts the brain and making us go into fight, flight, and freeze mode, right? We don't get taught any of that. And we live in a society that has us living in criminal conditions, right? Which all of the science shows that when you live in criminal conditions, you are more likely to be violent. Just because of how the brain works, right? Because it is a trauma space. Your brain becomes a trauma-impacted space. And so all of your decision-making is impacted. The pause that we're supposed to have. So there's a pause between the moment something happens to you and the moment you react to it. So that pause is supposed to be for you to think through consequences, think about what do you really value in your decisions, all of that stuff, right? But when we are impacted by traumas, literally the pause gets smaller and smaller in our brains. And in places like Baltimore, there's food apartheid in so many different neighborhoods, right? So again, thinking about the brain, your brain needs fresh fruits and vegetables, right? Healthy foods. You need that in your development. Your brain is not finished developing until you're like 25 or something crazy, right? And so, which is why we shouldn't sign up people to go off the war younger than that either, but that's a whole different interview. But my point is your brain is not finished developing until you are into your 20s. So if all of your life you were surrounded by blight, you were surrounded by nowhere to get fresh fruits and vegetables, there were only liquor stores and chicken box spots and places to go get hot Cheetos, you know what I mean? You didn't even get the sustenance that your body needs in order for your brain to develop the way it's supposed to help you make good choices in your life, because you functioning on hot Cheetos and chicken boxes. Right. And just the thought of finding a supermarket that has fresh fruits and vegetables, if you don't have transportation in a lot of places in Baltimore, that's just, you can only buy what you can carry home or what the corner store sells. So, yeah. So for us, it is hypocritical. So when you take all of the root causes of violence, right, all of the real reasons why so much violence shows up in a space, all of the science shows that it's tied to oppression and all of the impacts of oppression. And it is racial oppression, right? Because it is the myth of white supremacy. On the flip side of that coin is the myth of Black and brown inferiority. And so in Black and brown neighborhoods in a place like Baltimore, if you take the map of where all of the murders happen, right? And then you overlay that with the map of where all the liquor stores are in the city. And then you overlay that with the map of where all the abandoned houses and blight is in the city, right? These are gonna be the same map. It's not even like there's gonna be some of these that's like, oh, that's way far out of the, no. It's gonna be all the same concentrated areas. And then all of the places where there's affluent white people living, you see specks of any of these things. There's no blight. There's no abandoned houses. They don't have liquor stores on every corner. Definitely you cannot find a chicken box spot nowhere. You know what I'm saying? So it's just, if it's not intentional, I don't know what it is. But the truth of the, but meanwhile, we can't just call people murderers and pretend that we had nothing to do with it. Right, that the policies we make, that the laws we pass, that, you know, what we believe about some people's unearned privilege and some people's unearned oppression and how that shows up in life. Like, all of that created that moment of somebody getting killed. It wasn't just that person's decision in that moment. It was all of it that had something to do with somebody getting killed. So we take responsibility for that. And so for me, when you say the word forgiveness, I think about forgiveness as a very spiritual thing. So I look at forgiveness as I am remembering something about who this person is created to be that they have long forgotten. Right? So we all have amnesia about who we are created to be. It's why we doubt ourselves. It's why we think we got to do things in order to earn, you know, worth and popularity and greatness. Like, we don't really remember. We are fucking magnificent by design. End of story. Is never up for debate. Right? And so if most people function like that, not honoring their own magnificence, not even knowing that their magnificence is a thing to be honored. And then we have a society where some people are specifically taught that their magnificence is not a thing, while they have to watch other people have all kind of access and opportunities to be great, right? Then when murder happens or anything else happens, I know that in order to do that to somebody, you had to forget who you were created to be. You had to. You don't understand your greatness and your worth and your power. You don't. Because you believe that you get power from being violent, because that's what you've been taught everywhere you look. Right? So for me, forgiveness is not me saying the person shouldn't be held accountable or we should forget what the person did. That's not what forgiveness is. Forgiveness is understanding and accepting that person has amnesia about who their spirit being is. And then when I look into their life, where would they have learned? Where would they have known to be great? Right? And so it brings a compassion and an understanding, and it leaves the door open for people's redemption. Because if people can be held accountable, they can do their time, they can make whatever amends they can, but we gotta also make sure there's an opportunity for their redemption to be a real thing and for them to remember they are not just a murderer.
So one of the things that I'm hearing from you is kind of expanding an understanding that the mainstream of the country has about violence, and that actually it's not just one thing, but it actually is the result of multiple different factors. Mm-hmm. Where you are in a neighborhood, your access to healthy food, your access yeah. to housing and economic resources, as well as the way that one is racialized and has privilege yeah. and access. And so it seems like then some of the events that the movement is organizing is about not just bringing visibility, but also how people can process and deal with and move yeah. away from being numb to these
That's
things.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Don't be numb is a really huge part of our movement. And our goal is to find ways to address the root causes of violence. So we do that by pushing this narrative and the work of we are our own saviors. Doesn't matter who becomes president. Doesn't matter who becomes the next mayor. You know why? It's still shit to do in our neighborhoods. No matter who's the president or mayor of Baltimore, we still got to be doing the work, and people are still suffering and need resources. So while we are out doing outreach, we're not just telling people, hey, you know about the next ceasefire. Here's the peace challenge. Keep, you know, be safe, be peaceful, celebrate life. We're saying, what are you going through? What do you need? Because when you have real conversations with people, you're able to help connect them with resources that they need. And thereby, we are the saviors that we're waiting for all the time with each other, right? Helping each other get what we need so that people are less likely to be violent. So that's how, so the joy, the love, the saving each other, that is addressing some of the root causes of violence. But then also being, addressing the present traumas of violence as well. So showing up when somebody gets killed. And then in the aftermath of it, you know, whether it's doing sacred space rituals or being there for families and loved ones or whatever it is, right? But just making sure people know that it matters to us that your loved one was killed. I didn't have to get the visit from the homicide detective for it to break my heart that somebody was killed in the city.
I'm sitting with the description that you've been giving about the sacred space rituals as one of the ways to not be numb, and to honor the person who has passed as well as the family. And I'm wondering yeah. if you could speak a little bit more about what those rituals look like. Were they inspired by particular traditions or?
That's really good. So I'm gonna send y'all a link to a video. Maryland Public TV did a really good, it's like a 5-minute video. It was a video about the movement in general, but they really did a good job. They came to a sacred space ritual. So they did a good job kind of capturing the energy of it. So it is inspired. So it's inspired by, I don't know how else to say this, but okay. So for Black people in America, we don't often have a physical memory of our traditions that we can go and get, right? Because I don't really know what tribe in Africa I came from. I don't really know what my people did before we were here. I don't know how many indigenous people are actually in my bloodline. You know what I'm saying? I'm pretty sure it's some somewhere because my father, you know, was a historian and studied all of this shit and told us, like, you know, Black people were like going all around the country with indigenous people on their, you know, treks and had babies. That makes a lot of sense. That would explain a lot of what's going on my face. But, right. So there are not So there's a lot of oral history. There's a lot of pulling pieces from different African culture that just speaks to your spirit. Because unless you have the money and time and resources to do all of the genetic whatever to trace and pinpoint, you really don't know what your people did, right? But there are things that call to us. So we do know that burning sage and frankincense and stuff like that has been in African tradition since forever. God is very wise. You can look in almost any religion or spiritual tradition and you will find that people use sage and frankincense and myrrh and stuff in their ceremonies, in their blessings, Catholicism, you know, like it's everywhere. So it's not something that only belongs to one people. Although in America, indigenous people, like using sage specifically is huge in their traditions. And so sometimes indigenous people will see black people burning sage and might feel offended by it. And so we've had to have conversations with indigenous people in Baltimore about how it is a form of oppression for you to tell us we can't do something that our spirits lead us to do, that we know our ancestors have done, just because we can't put our finger on where those ancestors are from and you can, it's oppressive for you to tell us we can't burn sage because that belongs to y'all. And those conversations have gone beautifully. Mm-hmm. Not only have they gone beautifully, but it has built brotherhood and sisterhood between black people and indigenous people in Baltimore through the ceasefire movement. And it led even one meeting where they brought us their medicine, sweet grass and all kind for us to use in the rituals that we do. So that's where the burning sage came from. Like, I just knew, I ain't no shit. God said every spot need to be blessed. So when we did the first ceasefire in August, I told everybody, if somebody gets killed, we're going to show up at the space. We're going to gather around the spot where the person's body was, and we're going to pour love and light into that space, and we're going to make it sacred ground. Because the places where people get killed in Baltimore should be sacred ground. And the only way it can be is if we show up and make it so. I felt that way because I watched my mom after my brother was killed in 2007. He was killed in the neighborhood where we grew up. And it was a neighborhood we frequented often enough, even after we didn't, none of us lived there anymore. And I watched my mother avoid going anywhere near the block where my brother was killed. Years I watched her, she was not going anywhere near there. And it dawned on me one day that murder is an energy and a vibration, and those vibrations get left in the space. The anger, the confusion, the panic, the hatred, whatever all of it is, right? Between the person committing the murder and the person getting killed. That's a lot of vibrations that's in that space now because this thing has happened. And if you know that your person got killed somewhere, you feel that shit. Two blocks before you arrive into the space, you feel it in your body. And that's just not right. You know, like, my brother's life deserved more than for there just to be this dark hole left in the space where he left his body. Like, that's not cool. And so that's what made me say, if somebody gets killed during the ceasefire, we're gonna show up. When we did that very first sacred space ritual in August, because somebody got killed. So at that time in Baltimore, people were being killed every 19 hours. This ceasefire weekend, there were no murders for 41 hours. So it was a good weekend in Baltimore for a minute. You know what I mean? And you could feel it in the air. And so when this one person got killed, you could feel the whole city's heartbreak together. The numbness was not a thing that weekend at all, because everybody was now intentionally hoping for just life, right? So we get the call that somebody was killed. We show up at the space, we hold hands, you know, I say whatever I'm saying, I invite people to say what they're gonna say. And when everybody started dispersing, I was compelled to sit on the ground. So I'm like a hodgepodge of different religions and spiritual traditions. And there's this Buddhist chant that I do, Nam-myoho Renge-kyo. And one day I was chanting while driving, and the palm of my hand suddenly got so hot, it scared me for a second. Cause I was like, why is my palm like feeling like, I had to look at my hand to be like, is it, I know it's not on fire, but it was so hot. And it dawned on me, it was because I had raised the vibration in my body by chanting the way that I was. And the palms of our hands and the bottoms of our feet are very powerful energy points on our body. It's why elders, right, if you get sick, they will cut up onions and garlic and put them on the bottom of your feet and some socks, because it helps to draw out all the impurities out of your body through those energy points, right? So I was like, oh, that's why my palm got hot, right? So that was maybe, let's say, 2 years before I even thought about doing the ceasefire. But once I made a decision, oh, we're going to go to the murder spot, the reason I was compelled to get on the ground is because I had a physical memory in my body of how powerful the energy is that comes out of the palm of my hand when I raise my own vibration. And so I wanted to put all of that love and light from my body into the concrete where his body fell. A, so that he wasn't alone. Some of the things I'm telling you, I didn't realize why I was doing it until later. I knew that I was supposed to put my palm on the ground because of what had happened while I was chanting. I did not understand at first why I was putting my whole body on the ground. But it has to do with a pain-filled body fell, right? And they had that experience by themselves. And it's something about that that just feels, I'm a Libra. So all the things that feel unfair to me, I'm like, we need to do the opposite of that shit. Like, and balance this shit out. So I put my love-filled, light-filled body in the same spot that a pain-filled, fear-filled body fell, so that the person is not alone in their experience of their body being on the ground. And so that I'm doing something different with my body, right? Putting love and light in the space where your body was. And so, after that, but so that was August, and then we decided, oh, we're gonna do another ceasefire in November. And God came and was like, so you can't keep saying that the places people killed need to be sacred ground unless you're gonna do it. I was like, fuck. Because it's true, you can't keep saying something like that and then not do it. You just can't. I mean, you can, but you're not worth shit if you do. So I made a decision. I was like, oh, so after the November ceasefire, I'm going to just start showing up at every spot where somebody gets killed, and I'm going to bless the space and make it sacred ground. Just like somebody showed up to kill the person, we're going to show up to love the person. We did it. Every single one, I would say, from November of 2017, most of 2018. By 2019, we were exhausted and didn't even know why. And we were like hit and miss in 2019. Just from, I now know what was emotional and spiritual exhaustion, because I know I personally had not factored in addressing murder so intimately into my self-care. I was still doing regular people's self-care, right? I can't do regular people's self-care. I gotta do you face murder every day level of self-care, right? And so in 2020, at the end of 2019, I made a commitment to my own self. We're going to do every single spot. And so we've done every single spot this year.
There's so much.
Yeah, we burn sage, we burn frankincense, we burn camphor. People are welcome to do anything in the space. So people sometimes sing songs, pray, drum. This guy comes with his fiddle sometimes and plays his fiddle. Like, whatever you think puts love into the crevices of the atmosphere. Oh, and then, I just gotta say this part. And then, us starting to do that, what we notice is people would come up to us and be like, what y'all doing? And so we would tell them, they'd be like, oh, can you bless me? And so we would just end up smudging all kinds of people. Or people would go, can you come in my house and sage my house? They don't give a fuck that their house is tore up from the floor up on the inside. They don't care. They just want the love. So we go into people's houses and you know, do the smudge with the sage. And so it becomes such a thing that people like will stop. Now people, if they see smoke in the streets of Baltimore, they pull over and be like, can you bless me? Like, it's literally a real thing. So we made t-shirts now and hoodies for when we're doing sacred space rituals that say, come get the smoke. And then it has the ceasefire logo on the back. Yeah. So that was inspired because of the people of Baltimore always come and get the smoke. And so we're like, oh, come on. Yeah.
There's so much richness in what you shared. And I'm just thinking about, you know, on the one hand, a lot of conversations that Arielle and I have had in the context of these interviews around the relationship between Black and Indigenous solidarity. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of someone on social media who goes by the name Melanin Muskogee, who mm-hmm. is Black and Indigenous. And she also talks about how we need to remember that those people that were taken from Africa were also Indigenous and had their own tribal traditions and languages. So there's a lot that's happening right there that I'm trying to pay attention to and think about. The other thing I think is just how important ceremony is to deal with all of the violence and trauma and crisis that is happening in our world. One of my teachers would say that ritual is important because it helps us deal with those things that are too difficult to deal with alone.
So I feel like you almost made me cry, because in real life, when people ask me, like, well, how do you show up at every single murder spot? Because I have to do something with all of the pain of my own grief. Mm. Right? And so people can give me all the awards and they can call me a superhero and all of that. But at the end of the day, the foundation of why I do all of this work is my own pain. It's a selfish thing that I'm doing in Baltimore. I understand that the kind of pain that I carry. So my brother was killed. One of my stepsons was killed. Two of my first cousins were killed, brothers. So my aunt had three girls and three boys, and two of her boys have been killed. So just the amount of murder and my personal blood that is spilled on the streets of Baltimore, that kind of pain is either, you don't have a whole lot of choices around what to do with it. It's either going to swallow you up completely, or you have to find something to do with the pain to push it out into the world, right? To do the things in the world that you think need to be done so that other people don't have to go through the kind of pain that you are in. Or if they do go through it, they get a different kind of comfort, right? My mother didn't have somebody to bless the spot where her son was murdered. Nobody came and cleared all of that toxic energy. My mother didn't go to that spot until after the ceasefire started in 2018, she created an event called Sacred Space Saturday. And she said, now that, because I did go and bless the space after the ceasefire started, I said, I'm blessing all these spaces in my own brother's spot hadn't even been done. So I went and did his. And that made my mother feel a little bit better about coming. But to your point about people being alone, she didn't want to be the only one going to her son's spot. So she made an event. And she wanted everybody at the same time on this particular Saturday, show up at the place where your person was killed and leave something visible there. And she called it Sacred Space Saturday. And that was the first time she went to my brother's spot, because she said she could do it if she knew she wasn't doing it by herself. And that's exactly the reason I do everything that I do. It has to do with, and the ritual especially, like ceremony and ritual are very important to me. I love them. They inspire me. But it's the reason I can keep showing up at every murder. It would seem, right, on paper, given a person like me who's had so much trauma around violence, it should be ripping me to shreds going to every single murder spot, right? It should not be something I'm able to do. But I'm able to do it because it literally feeds me. It nurtures me because I'm aware that I'm using my broken heart to pour love and light into the world.
So I feel like I would like to just keep talking for hours and hours because of just the depth of what you're sharing. But to honor your time, we did agree to only an hour today. So I think we should stop. We should stop here for today. And
if y'all have some more questions, y'all can ask me. I don't have a. My next thing, I feel like it's not till like. I have time, is what I'm saying. I don't want to. If there are things you really want to make sure you ask me before we end, I have time.
I think. So I actually have to head out.
To go. Okay.
So we have a bunch of questions, and we can get in touch with you about timing. So I'm going to pause the recording for today.